dripping with sweat so I could finally go home. Pearl heard my bike approach, and she stood at the end of the drive waiting. I got off the bike and put my forehead on her forehead. I wished I could change places with her. I was holding Pearl when I heard my mother scream and scream again, and then I heard my father's low voice grinding between her shrieks. Her voice veered and fell, just the way I'd just been riding, crashing hard until finally it dropped to an astonished mutter. I stood outside holding my bike up, leaning on it. Pearl was next to me. Eventually, my father walked out the back screen door and lit a cigarette, which I had never seen him do. His face was yellow with exhaustion. His eyes were so red they seemed rimmed with blood. He turned and saw me. "They let him go, didn't they?" I said. He didn't answer. "Didn't they, Dad?" After a moment, he dragged on the cigarette, looked down. All of the electric poison that had drained out of me on my bike flooded back, and I began to harangue my father with words, stupid words. "All you catch are drunks and hot dog thieves." He looked at me in surprise, then shrugged and tapped the ash off his cigarette. "Don't forget the scofflaws and the custody cases." "Scofflaws? Oh, sure. Is there anywhere you can't park on the res? Try the tribal chairman's spot. And custody, nothing but pain. You said yourself, you got zero authority, Dad. One big zero, nothing you can do. Why do it anyway?" "You know why." "No, I don't." I yelled it at him and went in to be with my mother. But there was nothing to be with when I got there. She was staring blankly at the blank of the refrigerator, and when I stepped in front of her, she spoke in a weird, calm voice. "Hi, Joe." After my father entered, she went upstairs in a slow, devotional walk with him holding on to her arm. "Don't leave her, Dad, please." I said this in dread as he came back down alone, but he did not even glance at me to answer. I stood awkwardly across from him, dangling my hands. "Why did you do it?" I said to him, bursting out. "Why bother?" "You want to know?" He got up and went to the refrigerator and rummaged around and pulled something from deep on the back shelf. He brought it over to the table. It was one of Clemence's uneaten casseroles. There so long, the noodles had turned black, but stashed near enough to the cold refrigeration coils that it had frozen, and so didn't stink yet. "Why I keep on? You want to know?" With a savage thump, he turned the casserole over onto the table. He lifted off the pan. The thing was shot through with white fuzz, but held its oblong shape. My father rose again and pulled the box of cutlery from the cabinet counter. I thought he'd gone crazy at last, and watching him, I could hardly speak. "Dad, I'm going to illustrate this for you, son." He sat down and waved a couple of forks at me. Then, with cool absorption, he laid a large carving knife carefully on top of the frozen casserole, and all around it proceeded to stack one fork, another fork, one on the next, adding a spoon here, a butter knife, a ladle, a spatula, until he had a jumble somehow organized into a weird sculpture. He carried over the other four butcher knives my mother always kept keen. They were good knives, steel, all the way through the wooden shank. These he balanced precariously on top of the other silverware, then sat back, stroking his chin. "That's it," he said. I must have looked scared. I was scared. His behavior was that of a madman. "That's what, Dad?" I carefully said, the way you address a person in delirium. He rubbed his sparse gray whiskers. "That's Indian law." I nodded and looked at the edifice of knives and silverware on top of the sagging casserole. Okay, Dad. He pointed to the bottom of the composition and lifted his eyebrows at me. Rotten decisions? You've been into my dad's old Cohen handbook. You'll be a lawyer if you don't go to jail first. He poked at the fuzzy black noodles. Take Johnson versus McIntosh. It's 1823. The United States is 47 years old, and the entire country is based on grabbing Indian land as quickly as possible in as many ways as can be humanly devised. Land speculation is the stock market of the times. Everybody's in on it. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, as well as Chief Justice John Marshall, who wrote the decision for this case and made his family's fortune. The land madness is unmanageable by the nascent government. Speculators on treaty-held Indian land and on land still owned and occupied by Indians. White people are literally betting on smallpox. Considering how much outright grease is used to bring this unsavory case to court, a case pled by no less than Daniel Webster. The decision was startling. It wasn't the decision itself that still stinks, though it was the obiter dicta, the extra incidental wording of the opinion. Justice Marshall went out of his way to strip away all Indian title to all lands viewed, i.e., discovered, by Europeans. He basically upheld the medieval doctrine of discovery for a government that was supposedly based on the rights and freedoms of the individual. Marshall vested absolute title to the land in the government and gave Indians nothing more than the right of occupancy, a right that could be taken away at any time, even to this day. His words are used to continue the dispossession of our lands. But what particularly galls the intelligent person now is that the language he used survives in the law, that we were savages living off the forest, and to leave our land to us was to leave it useless wilderness, that our character and religion is of so inferior a stamp that the superior genius of Europe must certainly claim ascendancy, and on and on. I got it then. I pointed at the bottom of the mess. I suppose that's Lone Wolf versus Hitchcock. And T-Hit Ton. I asked Dad about the first knife he laid on the casserole, stabilizing it. Worcester versus Georgia. Now that would be a better foundation. But this one, my father teased a particularly disgusting bit of sludge from the pile with the edge of his fork. This one is the one I'd abolish right this minute if I had the power of a movie shaman. Oliphant versus Suquamish. He took the fork, and the stink wafted at me. Took from us the right to prosecute non-Indians who commit crimes on our land. So even if... He could not go on. I hope we'd clean the mess up soon, but no. So even if I could prosecute Lark... Okay, Dad, I said, quieted. How come you do it? How come you stay here? The casserole was starting to ooze and thaw. My father arranged the odd bits of cutlery and knives so they made an edifice that stood by itself. He had suspended Mom's good knives carefully. He nodded at the knives. These are the decisions that I and many other tribal judges try to make. Solid decisions with no scattershot opinions attached. Everything we do, no matter how trivial, must be crafted keenly. We are trying to build a solid base here for our sovereignty. We try to press against the boundaries of what we are allowed. Walk a step past the edge. Our records will be scrutinized by Congress one day, and decisions on whether to enlarge our jurisdiction will be made someday. We want the right to prosecute criminals of all races on all lands within our original boundaries. Which is why I tried to run a tight courtroom, Joe. What I am doing now is for the future, though it may seem small or trivial or boring to you. Now it was Cappy and me, the two of us, trying to break ourselves on the bike course. I'd ridden over to our construction site with him because he'd chopped up every piece of wood in his yard and reduced length after length to kindling. Still, this was not enough, and he wanted to go out and ride Sonya's ponies. In his state of mind, I thought, he'd ride them to death. Besides, I didn't want to see Sonya or Whitey either, but I was desperate to distract Cappy, so I told him that after we had cruised around and found Angus, we'd catch a ride to the horses, though I didn't mean it. From time to time, when we paused or wiped out, Cappy folded his hand on his heart and something crackled. I finally asked him what it was. It's a letter from her, and I wrote one back, he said. We were breathing hard. We'd raced. He pulled out her letter, waved it at me, and then carefully folded it back into its ripped envelope. Zelia had that cute round writing that all high school girls had, with little O's to dot the I's. Cappy waved another envelope, sealed, with her name and address on it. I need to get a stamp, he said. So we biked down to the post office. I was hoping Linda would not be working that day, but she was. Cappy put his money out and bought a stamp. I didn't look at Linda, but I felt her sad pop eyes on me. Joe, she said, I made that banana bread you like. But I turned my back on her and went out the door and waited for Cappy. That lady gave me this for you, said Cappy. He handed me a foil-wrapped brick. I hefted it. We got on our bikes and rode over to find Angus. I thought of throwing the banana bread at the side of a wall or in a ditch, but I didn't. I held on to it. We got to Angus's and he came out, but said his aunt was making him go to confession, which made us laugh. What is that? He nodded at the brick in my hand. Banana bread. I'm hungry, he said. So I tossed it to him, and he ate it while we made our way toward the church. He ate the whole thing, which was a relief. He balled up the foil and put it in his pocket. He redeemed it with his cans. I had assumed that while Angus went inside the church and made his confession, Cappy and I would wait outside under the pine tree, where there was a bench, or down at the playground. Though we didn't have a cigarette to smoke, but Cappy put his bike into the bike rack right alongside Angus's, and so I parked mine too. Hey, I said, are you going inside? Cappy was already halfway up the steps. Angus said, no, you guys can wait outside. It doesn't matter. I'm going to confession, said Cappy. What? Were you even baptized? Angus stopped. Yeah. Cappy kept on going. Of course I was. Oh, said Angus. Were you confirmed then? Yeah, said Cappy. When was your last confession? Angus asked. What's it to you? I mean, Father will ask. I'll tell him. Angus glanced at me. Cappy seemed dead serious. His face was set in an expression I'd never seen before, or to be more accurate, his expression and the look in his eyes kept shifting, between despair and anger and some gentle moony rapture. I was so disturbed that I grabbed him by the shoulders and spoke into his face. You can't do this. Cappy terrified me then. He hugged me. When he stood back, I could tell that Angus was even more dismayed. Look, I think I got the time wrong, he said. Please, Cappy, let's go swim. No, no, you've got the time right, said Cappy. He touched our shoulders. Let's go in. The church was nearly empty inside. There were a few people waiting for the confessional, and a few up front praying at the feet of the Blessed Virgin, where there was a rack of votive candles flickering in red glass cups. Cappy and Angus slid into the back pew, where they knelt, hunched over. Angus was closest to the confessional. He looked sideways at me over Cappy's bent head, made a rolling eye grimace, and jerked his head at the church door as if to say, "Get him out of here." After Angus went into the confessional and closed the velvet drape after him, he poked his head out and made that face again. I squeezed close to Cappy and said, "Cousin, please, I beg you, let's get the hell out of here." But Cappy had his eyes closed, and if he heard me, he made no sign. When Angus emerged, Cappy rose like a sleepwalker, stepped into the confessional, and shut the curtain behind him. There were arcane sounds, the slide of the priest's window, the whispering back and forth, then the explosion. Father Travis burst from the wooden door of the confessional and would have caught Cappy if he hadn't rolled out from under the curtain and half-crawled, half-scrambled along the pew. Father ran back, blocking the exit, but already Cappy had sprung past us, hurtling the pews toward the front of the church, landing on the seats, with each bound in a breathtaking series of vaulting leaps that took him nearly to the altar. Father Travis's face had gone so white that red-brown freckles, usually invisible, stood out, as if drawn on with a sharp pencil. He didn't lock the doors behind him before he advanced on Cappy, a mistake. He didn't count on Cappy's speed either, or on Cappy's practice at evading his older brother in a confined space. So for all Father Travis's military training, he made several tactical errors going after Cappy. It looked like Father Travis could just walk down the center of the church and easily trap Cappy behind the altar, and Cappy played into that. He acted confused and let Father Travis stride toward the front before he bolted to the side aisle and pretended to trip, which caused Father Travis to make a right-hand turn toward him down one of the pews. Once the priest was halfway along the pew, Cappy flipped down the kneeler and sped toward the open door, where we were standing alongside two awestruck old men. Father Travis could have cut him off if he'd run straight back, but he tried to get past the kneeler and ended up lunging along the stations of the cross. Cappy exited. Father Travis had the longer stride and gained, but instead of running down the steps, Cappy, well practiced as we all are at sliding down the iron pole banister, used that and gained impetus. A graceful push-off that sent him pell-mell down the dirt road with Father Travis too close behind for him to even grab his bike. Cappy had those good shoes, but so, I noticed, did Father Travis. He wasn't running in sober clerical blacks, but had perhaps been playing basketball or jogging before he dropped in to hear confessions. The two sprinted hotly down the dusty gravel road that led from the church into town. Cappy boldly crossed the highway, and Father Travis followed. Cappy cut through yards he knew well and disappeared, but even in his cassock, which he'd hoisted and tucked into his belt, Father Travis was right behind him, heading toward the dead Custer Bar and Whitey's gas station. We marveled at Father's pale, thick, muscled calves blurring in the sun. "What should we do?" "Stay ready," I said. Angus and I took our bikes from the rack and held Cappy's between us. We hoped he'd gain enough on Father Travis so he could jump on and we could pedal away. We watched a bit of road we could see far over the trees because it was there Cappy would appear if Father Travis didn't catch him. Soon, Cappy popped across. A moment later, Father Travis. Then they vanished and Angus said, "He's trying to lose him by zigzagging through the BIA housing. He knows those yards, too." We turned to watch the next patch of road where they would appear, and again it was Cappy first, Father Travis not far behind. Cappy knew the front and back entrances of every building and fled in and out of the hospital, the grocery, the senior citizens, the tiny casino we had back then. He doubled back through the dead Custer and in and out of Whitey's. He took the road we'd taken past old Lady Benici's, hoping he'd surprise the dogs and they'd fix their teeth in Father Travis's robe, but they made it through. Cappy hopscotched downhill through the graveyard, and then the two of them made a loop that took them through the playground. It was mesmerizing to watch. Cappy set the swings going and sprang through the monkey bars, lightly touching down. Father Travis landed like an ape, with knuckles on the ground, but kept going. They sprinted uphill. Two tiny ciphers, who now enlarged as Cappy ran toward us, ready to jump on the bike we held and sped off. We would have made it. He would have made it. He came so close. Father Travis put on a burst of speed that brought him within a hand's breadth of Cappy's shirt collar. Cappy floated out from under that hand, but it came down and grabbed his back wheel. Cappy jumped off the bike, but Father Travis, purple in the face, wheezing, had him by the shoulders and boldly lifted him. Angus and I had dropped our bikes to plead his case, although we couldn't have known for sure what Cappy planned to confess. It was now obvious. He had confessed what we feared he would confess. "Father, this does not look good," said Angus. "Let him down, please. Father Travis," I tried to imagine my father's voice in this situation. "Cappy is a minor," I said. Perhaps that was absurd. But Father Travis had hold of Cappy's shirt now and had raised his fist, and his fist stopped in the air. "A minor," I said, "who came to you for help, Father Travis." A wharf-like roar seized Father Travis, and he threw Cappy on the ground. His foot went back, but Cappy rolled out of range. We picked up our bikes because Father Travis wasn't moving now. He was standing there, breathing in deep gasps, head lowered, glaring from under his brow. We'd somehow gotten the upper moral ground in that moment, and we knew it. We got on our bikes. "Good day, Father," said Angus. Father Travis stared past us as we rode away.
"Shit in hell," I said to Cappy later. "What were you thinking?" Cappy shrugged. "You told him about the church basement where you did it?"
"Everything," said Cappy.
"Shit in hell."
Clements frowned at my language. "Sorry, Auntie," I said. We had gone to Clements and Edwards in hopes they were eaten, which they weren't. But that didn't matter, because Clements knew why we'd came over, and she immediately warmed up her usual hamburger macaroni, poured her usual swamp tea, only mixed for us specially, with a can of lemonade. She fed Mushum because he ate whenever anybody else ate, but his tremor had become so pronounced that he couldn't eat soup.
"Why'd you tell him?" I asked.
"I don't know," said Cappy. "Maybe what he said about his woman. Or what he said to me about, 'You be the one to notice her, remember?'"
"He said notice her, not, you know." I was delicate around Cappy, even though Clements wasn't listening right then. Although Cappy had had sex, it was on a higher plane, so I didn't use any sex words. He got upset when they were associated with anything that had happened between himself and Zelia.
"You could have gone to your dad, gone to your older brother, talked with them," I said.
"I'm glad I went to Father Travis, though," said Cappy, grinning. Cappy's run was already becoming history, and his reputation would soar. Father Travis was not damaged by it either, as we'd never had a priest in such fine athletic shape.
"The size of his calf muscles," said Clement.
"The last priest could not have run 10 yards, said Mushum. "I saw him laid out in our yard once, dead drunk. The old priest weighed more than you and your skinny friends all put together," he cackled. "But this new one has his pride. It will take him many prayers to get over Cappy's run."
"God help the gophers this week," said Uncle Edward as he passed through the room.
Clements brought a dish towel and tied it around Mushum's neck. Between bites, he said, "I ever tell you boys about the time I outrun Liver-Eatin' Johnson?
How that old rascal used to track down Indians and kill us and take and eat our livers. That was a white Wendigo. But when I was young and fleet, I run him down and whittled him away bite by bite and paid him back. I snapped off his ear with my teeth and then his nose. Want to see his thumb?
You told them, said Clement, who was intent on getting nourishment into his old gullet. But Mushum wanted to talk.
Listen here, you boys. People say Liver-Eatin' Johnson was supposed to have escaped some Indians by chewing through a rawhide that bound his hands. The story had it he killed the young Indian who was guarding him and cut off that poor boy's leg. Supposedly, that scoundrel run off with that leg into the wilderness and survived by eating it until he made his way into friendlier territory.
Open up, said Clements, and filled his mouth.
But that was not how it happened, said Mushum. For I was there. I was hunting with some Blackfeet warriors when they caught Liver Eater. They planned on delivering him to the Crow Indians because he had killed so many of their people. I was sitting with that young Blackfeet who was supposed to guard him, but he wanted to kill Johnson so bad his hands twitched. I talked to Liver Eater in the Blackfeet language, which he sort of understood. Liver Eater, I said, half the Blackfeet hate you so much they're going to stake you down butt naked and skin you alive. But they'll cut off your balls first and feed them to their old ladies right in front of your own eyes.
Say there, said Clements.
The Blackfeet's eyes just glowed, said Mushum. I said to Liver Eater that the other half of the Blackfeet wanted to tie him securely between their two best war ponies and then charge the opposite direction. The Blackfeet's boy's eyes sparked like candles at that. I told Liver-Eatin' Johnson that he was supposed to decide which of these fates he would prefer, so that the tribe could make preparations. Then we turned our backs on Liver Eater and warmed our hands over the fire. We left him to work on the rawhide thongs that bound his wrists. His ankles, too, were bound with strong ropes. Another rawhide at his waist fixed him to a tree. He had plenty to work on with his teeth, which were none too sturdy, and that's the point. You never saw a white trapper's teeth. But they hadn't the habits we Indians had of scrubbing our teeth clean with a birch twig. They let their teeth rot. You could smell his breath a mile before a trapper came into view. His breath generally smelled worse than the rest of him. And that is saying a lot, eh? Liver Eater's teeth were no different from any trapper's, and now he was trying to chew off his cords. Every so often, we would hear him curse and spit. There went one tooth, then another broke off. We panicked him into chawing until he was all gum. Never again could he bite into an Indian, but we planned to make him helpless altogether. This young Blackfeet and me, he had a potion from his grandma that would make your eyes cross. As soon as Liver Eater fell asleep and snored, we dabbed that medicine onto his eyes. Now he couldn't shoot straight. He would have to become a sheriff. That is, if the crows did not kill him. Still, you don't leave a rattlesnake alive to bite you next time you walk the path. I said to the Blackfeet, even if he don't have fangs. I wish we didn't have to give him to the crows, said the young man. They need their fun, I said. But just in case he gets loose, we should make sure he cannot pull the trigger on a gun. We could chop off his fingers, but then the crows would say we'd stolen some of him. There is a centipede. If it bites a man, his hands will swell up like mittens for the rest of his life, the Blackfeet told me. So we made little torches for ourselves and went around hunting for this bug. But while we were away, Liver Eater did manage to escape. When we returned, all we saw was chewed straps on the ground surrounded by broken brown teeth. He got away. Then he made up the story about eating the Indian's leg, because unless he had a good story, who'd believe a toothless, cross-eyed old bugger?
Exactly, said Clements.
Ah, oui. I'm going to miss that Sonya, said Musham, winking at me.
What?
Oh, said Clements.
Whitey says she cleared out. She played sick yesterday, and he came home to find her closet empty and one of the dogs gone with her. She took off in her old rattle-trap car he just fixed to run smooth.
Is she coming back? I said.
Whitey told me her note said never. He said he slept with the other dog. He was so broke up. She said he'd best clean up his act. Amen to that.
The news made me dizzy, and I told Cappy we needed to go somewhere. He said his usual polite and traditional thank you to Clements, and then we biked away together, slow. Finally, we got to the road that led, though it was a long ride off, to the hanging tree where Sonya and I had buried the passbook savings books. We stopped our bikes, and I told Cappy the entire story, finding the doll, showing it to Sonya, her helping me stash the money in those bank accounts, and then where we put the passbooks in the tin box. I told him about how Sonya insisted I keep quiet so as to not put him in danger. Then I told him about Sonya's diamond stud earrings and the lizard skin boots, and about the night Whitey beat on her and how it looked like she was planning to get away from him, and I told him how much money I had found.
She could get real far in that, he said. He looked away, offended.
Yeah, I should have told you.
We didn't talk for a while. We should go dig up the little box anyway, he said, just to make sure.
Maybe she left you some money, said Cappy. His voice was neutral.
Enough for shoes like yours, I said as we rode along.
I offered to trade, said Cappy. It's okay, I like mine now. I bet she left me a goddamn note. That's what I bet. We both turned out to be right. There was $200, one passbook, and a piece of paper.
Dear Joe, cash is for your shoes. Also, I am leaving you saving account to spend on an IV education out east.
I looked inside the passbook. It was $10,000.
Treat your mom good.
Someday you might deserve how good you grew up. I can have a new life with the money. No more of what you saw. Love anyways. Sonya.
What the hell, I said to Cappy. What's she mean, what you saw?
I struggled. I wanted to tell the whole dance, every how, every glidey move, and show him the tassel, but my tongue was stopped by obscure shame.
Nothing, I said. I split the cash with Cappy and put the passbook and letter in my pocket. At first, he wouldn't take the money, and then I said it was so he could get a bus ticket to visit Zelia in Helena. Travel money, then. He folded the bills in his hand. We started back home, and halfway there we scared up a pair of ducks from a watery ditch. After a couple of miles, Cappy laughed. I got a good one. How come ducks don't fly upside down? He didn't wait for me to answer.
They're afraid of quacking up.
Still happy with his wit, he left me at the door to have dinner with my mother and father. I went in, and although we were quiet and distracted and still in a form of shock, we were together. We had candied yams. which I never liked, but I ate them anyway. There was farmer ham and a bowl of fresh peas from the garden. My mother said a little prayer to bless the food, and we all talked about Cappy's run. I even told them Cappy's joke. We stayed away from the fact of Lark's existence, or anything to do with our actual thoughts. Chapter 10. Skin of Evil. Linda Wishkop rolled out from her car and trudged to our door. I let my dad answer her knock and slipped out the back way. I finally worked out my thoughts in regard to Linda and her banana bread, although these thoughts did not make sense. I couldn't argue myself out of them. Linda was responsible for the existence of Lyndon. She saved her brother, even though she knew by then he was a skin of evil. She now repelled me like she repelled him and her birth mother, though my parents didn't feel the same way. As it turned out, while I was in the backyard running this way and that with Pearl, playing tag, though we never touched but whirled around each other in an unceasing trot, Linda Wishkob was giving my father information. What she told him would cause him to accompany my mother to her office and back home for the next 2 days. On the third day, my father asked her to write him out a list for the grocery. He insisted that we go instead of her, and that she lock the door behind us and keep Pearl in the house. From all this, I gathered that Lyndon Lark was back in the area. My mind wouldn't go any further. I wasn't thinking about it. I couldn't stand thinking about it. It was out of my mind entirely when my father asked me to go to the grocery store with him. I had been on my way to meet up with Cappy and carve out a newer and faster series of jumps in the dirt. I resented going with my father to the grocery. But he said it would take two of us to decipher and find all the exact things my mother wanted, which, when I saw her slanted script with even the brand names listed and tiny bits of advice in choosing properly, looked like the truth. That we have a real grocery store and a reservation is no small thing. It used to be that, besides the commodity warehouse, food came from the tiny precursor store, Puffy's Place. The old store sold mainly non-perishable items, tea, flour, salt, peanut butter, plus surplus garden vegetables or game meat. It sold beadwork, moccasins, tobacco, and gum. For real food, our people had traveled off reservation 20 miles or more to put our money in the pockets of store clerks who watched us with suspicion and took our money with contempt. But with our own grocery now, run by our own tribal members and hiring our own people to bag and stock, we had something special. Even though the pop machine out front was banged in, the magic doors swished shut on slow grandmas, and children smudged the gumball machine until you couldn't see the colors of the candy, it was our very own grocery. Trucks came to it like a regular store, stocked it, and then drove away. My father and I walked in past the wall of tattered powwow posters and ads for cars to sell. We got a grocery cart. Dad unfolded the list. Dried pinto beans. I pointed out that Mom had instructed us to shake and examine the plastic bag of beans and make sure it contained no small rocks. We located the beans in the pasta aisle. "A spotted pebble is going to look just like a bean," I said to my father, turning the rectangular package this way and that. "We should stock up," said my father, throwing 6 or 7 bags into the cart. "These are cheap. We can spread the beans in a pan and check for rocks when we get home." Tomato paste, canned tomatoes, Rotel, the kind with chilies, 4 cans each, 5 pounds of hamburger meat. "Lean if you can get it," the list said. Lean? Why would she want lean? "Less grease," said my father.
I like Greece. Me too. He threw some packages into the cart.
Cumin, I read. In the spice aisle, we found cumin. She was making extra food to bring to Clements, pay her back for all the dinners. I read, lettuce, carrots, then onions, and we're supposed to smell the onions first to make sure they aren't rotten inside.
Fruit. Whatever fruit is good, said my father, peering over my shoulder at the list. I guess we are able to make that decision anyway, regarding the fruit. What do you think?
We looked at a pile of muskmelons. Some had spots. There were grapes. All had spots. There was a bucket of local berries and some plums. Dad chose a melon and filled paper bags with plums, and a plastic mesh bucket with the berries. We bought chicken, an anemic-looking fryer, cut up, and we counted all the package pieces like she said. We bought another package that contained only thighs. We bought barbecue sauce and old Dutch potato chips for me. A couple of cans of mushroom soup went into the cart. At the bottom of the list was milk and butter, a 1-pound box of wrap sticks, salted, and 1-pound wrapped whole, sweet, cream.
What does she mean, wrapped whole? My father stopped beside me, frowning at the paper. He held a carton of cream in one hand. Why sweet? Why salted?
I was pushing the cart in front of my dad, and so I saw Lyndon Lark first. He was leaning into the cold light of the open meat case. My father must have looked up just after I did. There was a moment where all we did was stare, then motion. My father threw the cream, surged forward, and grabbed Lark by the shoulders. He spun Lark, jamming him backward, then gripped Lark around the throat with both hands. As I've said before, my dad was somewhat clumsy, but he attacked with such an instinct of sudden rage it looked slick as a movie stunt. Lark banged his head against the metal racks of the cooler. A carton of lard smashed down, and Lark slipped in the burst cream, scraping the back of his head down the lower edge of the case, ringing the shelves. The glass doors flapped against my father's arms as he fell with Lark, still pressing. Dad kept his chin down. His hair had fallen in strings about his ears, and his face was dark with blood. Lark flailed, unable to put a similar grip on my father. I was on him too now, with the cans of Rotel tomatoes. The thing was, Lark seemed to be smiling. If you can smile while being choked and can-beaten, he was doing it, like he was excited by our attack. I smashed the can on his forehead and opened a cut just over Lark's eye. A pure black joy in seeing his blood filled me. Blood and cream. I smashed as hard as I could, and something, maybe the shock of my happiness or Lark's happiness, caused my father to let go of Lark's throat. Lark kicked upward and pushed with all his might. My father went skidding backward. With a hard jolt, my father landed in the aisle, and Lark fled in a scrambled crouch. That was when my father had his first heart attack. It turned out to be a small one, not even a medium one, just a small one. But it was a heart attack. In the grocery store aisle, in the spilt cream and rolling cans, next to the Prel shampoo, my father's face went a dull yellow color. He strained for breath. He looked up at me, perplexed. And because he had his hand on his chest, I said, "Do you want the ambulance?" When he nodded yes, everything went out of me. I went down on my knees, and Puffy made the call. They tried to tell me I couldn't ride with him to the hospital, but I fought. I stayed with him. They couldn't make me leave him. I knew what happened if you let a parent get too far away. We stayed down in Fargo for almost a week and spent the days at St. Luke's Hospital.
On the first day, my father had an operation that is now routine, but which at the time was new. It involved inserting stents into three arteries. He looked weak and diminished in the hospital bed, although the doctors said that he was doing well. Of course, I was afraid. I could only look in at him, at first, from the hall. When he was moved into his own room, things were better. We all sat together and talked about nothing, everything. This seems odd, but it soon became a kind of vacation to be there, safe, together, our conversation vague. We'd walk the halls, pretend shock at the mushy food, talk some more about nothing. At night, my mother and I went back to the room we shared at the hotel. We had twin beds. On other trips, the three of us had always bunked together, Mom and Dad in a double. I would sleep on a rollaway in some corner. This was the first time I could remember staying alone anywhere with just my mother. There was an awkwardness. Her physical presence bothered me. I was glad she brought Dad's old blue bathrobe made of towel cloth, the one she kept pestering him to get rid of. The nap was worn down in places, the sleeve unraveling, the hem frayed. I'd thought that she'd brought it for him, but then she put it on the first night. I imagined she had forgotten her own robe, which was printed with golden flowers and green leaves. But the second morning I woke early and looked over at her, still sleeping. She was wearing my father's robe. I checked that night to see if she was wearing his robe on purpose. And sure enough, she got into bed wearing it. The room wasn't cold. It occurred to me the next day, as I was wandering around the park outside the hospital, that it would feel good if I had something of Dad's to wear, too. It would tie us together somehow. I needed him so much. I couldn't really go into it very far, this need. Nor could my mother and I talk about it. But her wearing his robe was a sign to me of how she had to have the comfort of his presence in a basic way that I now understood. That night, I asked her if she packed Dad an extra shirt. And she nodded when I asked her if I could wear it. She gave it to me. I still have many of his shirts and his ties as well. He purchased everything he wore at Silverman's in Grand Forks. They carry the very best men's clothing, and he didn't buy much, but he was particular. I wore my father's ties to get me through law school at the University of Minnesota, and the bar exam after. For the time, I was a public prosecutor. I wore his ties for the last week of every jury trial. I used to carry around his fountain pen, too, but I became afraid of losing it. I still have it, but I don't sign my tribal court opinions with it the way he did. The unfashionable ties are enough. The golden tassel in my drawer, and that I have always had a dog named Pearl. I was wearing my father's shirt on the day he stopped being vague. The second to last day we were there, he saw his shirt on me and looked quizzical. My mother left to get some coffee and I sat with him. This was the first time I was really alone with him. It did not surprise me that even while his incisions were healing, he chose to revisit the situation. To ask if I knew anything of Lark's whereabouts. I had been thinking the same way, but of course I didn't. If Clements had told my mother in their phone conversations from the hotel room, I didn't know about it. But then that night, I did get a call. It was while my mother was out buying a newspaper. It was Cappy. Some members of our family paid a visit, he said. I didn't know what he was talking about. Here? No, there. Where? They brought him around. What? The holodeck, dummy. It was a situation like when Picard was the detective. Remember, the persuasion. Right. I was flooded, tingling with relief. Right.
Is he dead?
No, just persuaded. They messed him up good, man. He won't come around, you. Tell your mum and dad. After the call, I was thinking how to tell them. How to make it sound like I didn't know it was Doe and Randall and Whitey, even Uncle Edward, who went to Lark's when another call came in. My mother had come back. I could tell the call was from Opeachy when my mother asked if there was something wrong at the office. The cadence of the voice, tiny in the receiver, was shrill and intense. My mother sat down on the bed. Whatever she heard wasn't good. Eventually, she put the receiver in its cradle, and then she curled up on the bed, her back to me. Mom? She didn't answer. I remember the buzz of lights on in the bathroom. I walked around to the other side of the bed and knelt down beside it. She opened her eyes and looked at me. At first she seemed confused, and her eyes searched my face, almost as if she were looking at me for the first time, or at least after a long absence. Then she focused, and her mouth creased in a frown. She whispered, "I guess people beat him up." "That's good," I said, "yeah." And then Opeachy says, "He drove back all crazy and blasted up to the gas station. He said something to Whitey about his rich girlfriend, how Whitey's rich girlfriend had herself a nice setup, and he was thinking of joining her. He drove through, yelling, making fun of Whitey. He got away. Whitey chased him with a wrench. What was he talking about? Sonia isn't rich." I sat there with my mouth open. "Joe?" I put my head down in my hands, my elbows on my knees. After a while, I laid down and put a pillow over my head. "This room's hot," said my mother. "Let's get the blower going." We cooled off and went into a little restaurant called the 50s Cafe for hamburgers, french fries, chocolate shakes. We ate silently. Then all of a sudden, my mother put down the hamburger. She laid it on her plate and said, "No." Still chewing, I stared at her. The slight droop of her eyelid gave her a critical air. "Is there something wrong with that burger, Mom?" She gazed past me, transfixed by a thought. The knife crease shot up between her eyebrows. "It's something Daddy told me. A story about a Wendigo. Lark's trying to eat us, Joe." "I won't let him," she said. "I will be the one to stop him." Her determination terrified me. She picked up her food and deliberately, slowly began to eat. She didn't stop until she finished all of it, which also frightened me. This was the first time since the attack she ate all the food on her plate. Then we went back to the room, got ready for bed. My mother took a pill and fell asleep at once. I stared at the feeble, soundproofing insulation tiles on the ceiling. If I watched them closely enough, I could feel my heart wind down. My chest opened and my stomach stopped grinding. I counted out, slowly and evenly, 78 random holes in the tile just over my head, and 81 in the next. If my mother went after Lark, he'd kill her. I knew this. I counted the holes again and again. On the day we left Fargo, I woke early. My mother was up, in the bathroom, making brushing and washing sounds. I listened to the shower water rattle down. The hotel curtains were so heavy, I didn't know that it was pouring outside, too. One of those rare August rains that tamped down the dust flares on the roads had just begun. A rain that washes the whitened, dust-coated leaves. A rain that fills the cracks in the earth and revives the brown grasses. That grows the corn by a foot and makes a second cutting of hay possible. A gentle rain that lasts for days. There was a chill in the air that persisted all the way home. My mother drove with the windshield wipers going, the coziest of sounds to a boy drowsing in the back seat. My father stayed alert beside my mother, covered with a quilt. From time to time, I'd open my eyes just to see them. He had his hand across the seat, resting on her leg above the knee. Occasionally, she took one hand off the wheel, reached down, and rested her hand on top of his. During this ride of peace, so like my earliest memories of going places with my parents, it came to me what I must do. A thought descended into me as I lay beneath my own soft old quilt. I pushed it out. The thought fell back. 3 times I pushed it out, each time harder. I hummed to myself. I tried to talk, but my mother put her finger to her lips and pointed at my father, who was asleep. The thought came again, more insistent, and this time I let it in and reviewed it. I thought this idea through to its conclusion. I stood back from my thought. I watched myself think. The end of thinking occurred. When we got home, Clements had fixed the chili. Puffy had delivered all the groceries that we had picked out. Everything we needed was stowed in the cupboards and the refrigerator. I saw my box of potato chips right away, sitting on the counter. I thought of the cans of tomatoes I had used as weapons. Clements had probably opened them and added them to the chili. Every day since the grocer, I wished I had brained Lark. I imagined myself killing him over and over, but since I hadn't, I was going to visit Father Travis first thing in the morning. I decided I would join his Saturday morning catechism class. I thought he would let me do that. I also hoped that if I made myself useful afterward up at the church, he might notice how the gophers had been driven from the tunnels by the rain and now were fattening on the new grass. They needed to be dealt with. I hoped that Father Travis might teach me how to shoot gophers so that I could get some practice. I wasn't exactly starting from scratch when it came to being a Catholic. Priests and nuns have been here since the beginning of the reservation. Even the most traditional Indians, the people who kept the old ceremonies alive in secret, either had Catholicism beaten into them in boarding school or had made friends with some of the more interesting priests, as Mushum had for a time, or they had decided to hedge their bets by adding the saints to their love of the sacred pipe. Everybody had extremely devout or at least observant family members. I had been lobbied over and over, for instance, by Clements. She had persuaded my mother, she hadn't bothered with my father, to have me baptized and had campaigned for my first communion and confirmation. I knew what I was in for. The God Squad had not been doctrinal, but my classes would be filled with lists. Confession, 1, sacramental, 2, annual, 3, sacrilegious, 4, legal, grace, 1, actual, 2, baptismal, 3, efficacious, 4, elevating, 5, habitual, 6, illuminating, 7, imputed, 8, interior, 9, irresistible, 10, natural, 11, prevenient, 12, sacramental, 13, sanctifying, 14, sufficient, 15, substantial, 16, at meals, 17. There were also actual, formal, habitual, material, moral, original, and venial sin. There were special types of sins. those against the Holy Ghost, sins of omission, sins of others,
sin by silence,
and the sin of Sodom. There were sins crying out to heaven for vengeance. There were, of course, definitions of each of these categories on the list.
Father Travis taught like Vatican II had